episode 27, and literally off the heels of the NBA Finals Game 6, Jim and I are, as we've said before, dedicated podcasters for you, staying up all night, watching the game, breaking it down before we even get on here and start recording. It's about 10 o'clock at night here on Tuesday night at recording this podcast to make sure that we can get the latest out for you guys. Chris Abbas, as always, Bright Side of the Sun podcast here, and Jim Kochenour back in the co-pilot seat. We are back in effect. PLR, the Sports K, Paul Richardson was on last week, but and special thanks for him for filling in. I think it turned out pretty well, but it's time for the dynamic duo to get back at it. Now, Jim, there's a little bit of hyperbole in this question, but Chris Bosh said that Danny Green would not get an open look tonight. Is that what he meant? That final corner play at the end of the game, at the end of overtime, was that what he meant? Did he predict that?
I don't think that that was necessarily what he had in mind there. Before we got this going earlier today, we talked about it, this a little bit, and decided that we were not going to start recording until shortly after the game, if it was close, so that we get a chance to watch it. And that was a great game to watch, in my opinion. But the theme for me wasn't Chris Bosh and his shutdown, lockdown defense. It was the officiating influencing the game. And I know some people don't like whining about the officiating, but in the closing seconds of this game in overtime, there were two obvious blown calls, no calls, when Ginobili was obviously fouled by Ray Allen. He ripped right across his right arm there on the drive in the lane. And then what you were alluding to, the Chris Bosh block shot / body check on Green, sending him out of bounds and ending the game. And in that type of situation, it absolutely impacts the outcome of the game. That those two decisions, those two, you know, decisions to swallow the whistles, and especially the last one, because there is no way on God's green earth that you could convince me that the officials didn't see that, because that's exactly where they're looking, and it was obvious. The guys on ABC said both calls were obvious, but they missed the calls. It's one of the problems that keeps the NBA from being more of a mainstream sport, because the fans watch this stuff, and some of the, not the diehards, but some of these casual fans see this and see how bad the officiating is. I know that it's very difficult to officiate NBA games because of the speed of the game, but when they have the ability to show the replays of all this, it just makes the referees look like idiots, and it makes the game look like it's unfair. And I know for me personally that I've almost been driven away from the game at times because of the terrible officiating and because of how those types of decisions have ruined my team's chances. And it's one of the biggest issues the league faces, in my opinion.
This series has been interesting because I was looking at some numbers, and if I asked you, have you watched all the games, Jim? Have you seen all of them?
I haven't watched every minute of every game while I was on my hiatus, my nice relaxing vacation, getting away from all you guys at Brightside that incessantly bother me on a regular basis. I caught just the second half of the 36-point blowout and missed part of another game, but I've watched at least parts of every game, if not the full one.
So a reason I asked that is because I just wanted to make sure to get a kind of feel on what your feel is for the series and how you've watched it. So if you were to ask anybody that had seen all the games, and even you that had, like you said, watched pretty much all the games, one would say the Spurs have dominated the offensive glass and dominated the second chance points. Would you probably say that?
Yes, Dave. I would say that based off the fact that they're really beating up Miami in the lane, and that even at 37 years old, Tim Duncan is, you know, completely overmatches anybody that the Heat have inside.
Yeah, and I thought the same thing, and about halftime for this game, I decided to go and just pull the numbers, and through this game, obviously, I'm going to give you the totals all the way through. The Spurs are only offensively, they've only out-rebounded the Heat by 4 overall total offensive rebounds, and they've only outscored them on second chance points by a total of 6. So they're plus 4 in the offensive rebounding category, and they're plus 6 in the second chance points. They obliterated them in two games. In game one and game three, it was a 41-19 advantage on the second chance points, and it was a 25-18 advantage on the offensive rebound. So they took care of business in those two games that they ironically won. But that was something that kind of stood out for me in this game as I'm watching it, and the Spurs and the Heat played dead even in that category, and it allowed the Spurs to not be able to pull away, because what had helped them with pulling away in these games was Kawhi Leonard and Tim Duncan killing the offensive glass and finishing up second chance points, or killing the offensive glass and getting the ball out to Danny Green and Neal and those guys hitting threes. That didn't happen necessarily today. It was dead even. It was 12-12 in the offensive rebound, 17-17 in the second chance points. The Spurs didn't get a chance to really get hot from three. They were only 5 of 18, while the Miami Heat were actually 11 of 19. So, it was a little bit of a different game. The Spurs, granted, it ending the way it ended and being a three-point game, and the Spurs all the way at the end having a chance to tie it after being in control for most of the fourth quarter, that kind of stood out to me, is that the Heat were able to take away the three ball and were able to play with them basically punch for punch in the paint with those second chance points on the offensive glass. And that allowed the Miami Heat. The Miami Heat, this is crazy, but it almost feels like they have to play a perfect game to beat the San Antonio Spurs. And the same thing with the San Antonio Spurs, which I think has made this a great series, that each team has to play near perfect to win. And game one and game six, great games. You know, 2, 3, and 4 were all, counter punches, basically. One team gets a blowout, the next team counter punches and gives the other team the blowout. But games one and six, respectively, were incredible. And, I mean, that's all you can hope for with game seven. So we move towards a game seven tomorrow on Thursday night. And, if we get a fraction of what this game was, or we get something parallel to what this game was, this is an all-time classic NBA Finals.
Yeah, I agree. I think it should be a really entertaining game seven. Hopefully it'll be close like this one, and hopefully there won't be any shenanigans at the end of the game that detract from that. Because this was a really good, really entertaining game. The shots that were hit by both teams, Tony Parker pulled off a couple, nice three-pointer and another two there at the end, and then the Miami Heat returned, served there with a couple threes at the end, forced the overtime. And so there was a lot of really good basketball. And I'm one of the rare Suns fans, I would say, the very rare Suns fans that is actually cheering for the Spurs in this series. I don't consider them an all-time rival. I think that there was a very short period where the teams were rivals, and now that the Spurs have maintained their excellence and the Suns have sunk to their depths, I don't think that rivalry exists anymore. The players I used to despise on those teams, loathe, like Bruce Bowen, who was intentionally trying to injure players, and Robert Horry, who was just generally a punk in my estimation, are gone, and now they have new young players like Green and Kawhi Leonard that I like, and I think they're one of the most exciting teams to watch in the NBA. And I'm just not a fan of the Heat's plan of contrived greatness and jumping to a big market and riding each other's coattails and the whole Heat and Serve championship theory. So I'm looking forward to it. I think it should be a great game. I'm sure everybody will be tuned in.
Now, quick basketball knowledge question, and I'm putting you on the spot, and I apologize for this. This was not in the production meeting. As you guys have seen, we have a world-class notes in preparation. But 2009-2010 season, the year before the trio came together, name as many players as you can that were on the Miami Heat roster that are not currently on the roster. So I'm excluding Dwayne Wade and Udonis Haslem and Mario Chalmers from this equation. Name as many players as you can on the 09-10 Miami Heat. Go.
We had Michael Beasley was there because they were cutting cap space there, so they had him still around.
Ding, ding,
obviously,
ding.
Dwayne Wade was the recruiting tool that they were using to draw in the other two of their triumvirate there. Wasn't Chalmers, I think, and Haslem that are still playing, weren't they both on that roster?
Yeah, so as many as you can remember that aren't currently on the roster that were also there. So those three were there.
Oh, that aren't currently on the roster?
Yeah.
Okay, well, Michael Beasley's not there anymore.
As we all know.
As we all know. not at the top of my head, I don't think I can name anybody else.
Now, you got one more that I'm sure 90% of quote-unquote Miami Heat fans would have gotten. I apologize if you're listening to this and you're a quote-unquote Miami Heat fan. But unless you're looking at Basketball Reference or you Googled it while I was asking, you don't remember Michael Beasley or Jermaine O'Neal or Quentin Richardson, all former Suns, being on that team. And not just being on that team, but basically being the other starters wrapped around Dwayne Wade for the entire season. Also, the likes of Darrell Wright and Rafer Skip-to-my-Lou Alston, Carlos Arroyo, Daquan Cook, James Jones, Shavlik Randolph, Joel Anthony is also still on the team, Jamal McGlure, and I'm not going to try and pronounce his name, but Yukabwa Diawara. I'm always really bad with names that are not Paul Johnson or Dave Thomas and real easy stuff, but I mean, that, as you said, the recruiting tool was Dwayne Wade, and you could tell by that 09-10 roster why he was a recruiting tool, because, you know, they had a pretty subpar to paltry roster. And I just like to ask that because basketball fans and enthusiasts probably don't remember that much, and I know for sure Miami Heat fans don't remember that the players that were on that roster before the All-Star crew got together. And that's just a little quick little history lesson there that just not but 3 years ago, the Miami Heat were relying on Quentin Richardson, not LeBron James, and Michael Beasley, not Chris Bosh, and so on and so forth. Three former Suns on there. I thought that was pretty interesting.
Yeah, I should have got Jermaine O'Neal. Now I'm thinking about it for a second. That was kind of an obvious oversight on my behalf. But
It was.
To be honest, the only reason that Michael Beasley came so quick to mind is because we ended up getting stuck with his ass after the fact. So,
hey, we ended up with Jermaine O'Neal as well. And you know what? Jermaine O'Neal was actually a quality acquisition. And I'm pretty sure the Miami Heat are looking back at during that Indiana series going, if we just had 10 to 12 minutes of Jermaine O'Neal off the bench to go out there and, you know, bully around with a guy like Roy Hibbert and bang those guys around like they're doing to us and give us six hard, hard veteran fouls. But so to transition.
No, they got Chris Bosh in there for their inside presence. Chris
exactly.
Bosh, he's all over that.
Yeah, and Joel Anthony, the man that plays with wrists, not hands. His arms stop at the wrist area. Because that guy can't catch a basketball to save his life.
Now, didn't you say he was one of the other players that was on the team a couple of years ago?
Completely forgot. He was all the way at the bottom of the roster when I was looking at it. It's an alphabetical roster, so I think that they're trying to forget that Joel Anthony was/is on the roster right now. Now, to go forward.
Now, that makes him like an anchor tenant. Maybe he was really the one recruiting those other guys, and Dwayne Wade was just, window dressing.
He was a sleeper. Either that or it was, Mario Chalmers out there using his Alaskan connection and roots and getting out there and getting on the floor and getting everybody into town to play with Dwayne Wade. He was the recruiter guy. So, well, now to transition real quick and to move on to more Suns related topics, spent enough time talking national and Miami Heat and topical stuff that's going on right now, but some other stuff that's going on right now, the Phoenix Suns had another workout today, as you saw with the write-up on the website just earlier yesterday, where they brought in basically a group of potentially undrafted, maybe some guys that are going to be considered or looked at number 57. I thought the workout was interesting from the respect that some of the names were actually, they stood out. I mean, Corey Lucius was in town for the third time. I really hope that the Suns have put him up into, maybe he has his own locker. Maybe he took over the double locker from Goran Dragic. He's doing them so many favors coming down for the workouts that Corey Lucius, they need to take care of him. They also had in Elston Turner Jr. That name may sound familiar because the wrongfully booted Elston Turner, the former defensive coordinator of the Phoenix Suns assistant coach, is his father, and he was in for the workout, as well as Sherwood Brown from Florida Gulf Coast, that Dunk City NCAA tournament group, Ian Clark, the point guard from Belmont, Stephen Pledger, a big combo guard from Oklahoma, and then Michael Snayar from Florida State. You may remember him well from his four game winners during his career over the past two seasons, most notably the one against Duke last year from the corner three. So they had a group of guys where, I mean, you might see a guy like Snayar get his name called. You might see Elston Turner Jr. get his name called. But for the rest of the group, more than likely looking at D-League, Summer League type guys, maybe getting a feel for some more Summer League guys, a little bit more on Summer League in a minute, but not really anyone that I see the Suns showing genuine interest in. And you can speculate about Corey Lucius being here three times in a row. The kid was just in town, and he volunteered his services saying, I'm going to be in here in town, just give me a call and let me know, and I'll be down there for a workout. So that's the reason why he's been here. But hey, if they draft him at 57, that's a nice story.
So Corey Lucius is kind of like the guy that accidentally got the Suns' phone number and keeps calling despite the fact that they wish he'd go away.
No, he's actually the one where the Suns got his phone number and they keep calling him and he wished that they would go away because he's been down here for three workouts and it's not even a guarantee that he's going to get drafted in general. And he's basically it feels like he's doing the Suns a nice solid, and he's also creating that relationship to maybe, you know, pull a Deontay Garrett, maybe get on, or a PJ Tucker, you know, get on a summer league team, play for a couple of years, show that value, get used to a system, get a team used to you in general, and then get that courtesy signing to go into a season. Hey, we gave PJ Tucker a courtesy signing, and he turned out to be one of the top three players on the roster last year. Corey Lucius could, you know, maybe down the road, maybe he'll be that guy where he'll get a courtesy signing from a team, maybe the Suns, and, you know, be a guy that can make an impact on a roster and play in the NBA. I mean, if he's not going to get drafted this year, you can obviously tell where his ceiling is as a prospect. But he's a guy that maybe down the road after a couple of summer leagues might be able to get onto an NBA team.
I don't really scout college players at all. I know some of the headliners, and I do some research heading up to the draft to kind of get a good feel on those players, but these guys are going to be off the radar for me. I know the Brown kid from that NCAA run. Like, I think you mentioned that in your story, and so that made him memorable to me. Corey Lucius. I figured that someone like you, of your pedigree and purview, probably knows who his sister is dating right now, what his favorite color is, what his childhood pet's name was, stuff like that, but I've never heard of the guy. And then, well, we had Elston Turner Jr.
Yeah.
Who I can already see that playing out right now. What the Suns are going to do is they're going to invite him to the summer league so he can play on the team, get a tryout there. But instead, they're going to sit his ass on the bench the entire time, then waive him at the end of the summer league to make sure he has no chance to actually get on another team, because that's how the Suns like to do Turners.
You know what? And that is, he actually took everything in stride. He got asked a couple of questions about his dad, obviously, and, you know, everyone brought up the fact that Elston Turner, you know, for the fans out there that didn't watch a lot of him play basketball this year, he lit up Kentucky for 40-plus earlier this year. And got a big win against, you know, I mean, Kentucky was a shell of itself this year. It wasn't a national championship contender, but he lit them up for 40, had a huge night. And, you know, I actually remember I think it was the following day or 2 days later where the Suns had a home game. And Elston Turner's, you know, pretty low-key, pretty chill guy where, you know, not a lot of smiles, not a lot of talking, kind of quiet and stays to himself. He was just beaming that whole night, and all he was doing was talking about his son, you know, torching Kentucky and having that big game. So, you know, he got asked a lot about his dad and, you know, didn't really give anything. But, you know, it's kind of interesting that I was talking to Paul Coro, and a lot of the workouts that Elston Turner have got so far have been through connections of his dad, where you can almost kind of picture him maybe making a phone call going, can you do me a favor? He's worked out for Houston, where that's where the family lives. He's worked out for the Minnesota Timberwolves, where you know, Rick Adelman, the former head coach that was working with Turner for a while, is coaching. And then, you know, here with the Phoenix Suns, where Turner was just, you know, for the past couple of seasons. So, yeah, you know what? I don't know the favorite color of all these guys, but I definitely know the talent level and the ceiling and got a feel for them. And like I said, I don't know if any of these guys are even draft worthy in this year's draft. They might be guys that are going to have to, you know, get their passports updated, head off to Europe and begin their careers out there, or truck it out in the D League and, you know, wait to hear their name get called up to the next level. Because, you know, guys like Sherwood Brown and Michael Starr and Elston Turner Jr., these guys are all good stories, but, you know, athletically and skill set wise, they may not be a group of guys individually that can make it into the NBA. This was an interesting workout. It was all guards/wings. There was no big, so 3-on-3 was, you know, a lot of probably ISO heavy, and, you know, with the guards trying to show what they got offensively. So the team, you know, got a feel for what these guys can do on the perimeter, I'm sure.
Not to try to make the rest of the show about Turner Jr. or lob too many salvos at the Suns organization, but I was just thinking, maybe since he's got these tryouts and everything based off a connection through his dad, like you were kind of surmising, he can get a tryout for the Memphis Grizzlies once they hired Alvin Gentry as their coach. He just had a second interview with them, so maybe that'll work out for Alvin. And then, in turn, it can work out for Turner Jr., because obviously Gentry wasn't qualified to coach a 25-win team here in Phoenix, but it appears that he's right in the running to coach a Western Conference finalist.
Yeah, you know what? How interesting would that be to go from a guy like Lionel Hollins, who, you know, kind of feels a little bit like the Alvin Gentry style. He's obviously got his own coaching style and technique and everything, but, you know, Lionel Hollins is good with good talent, was, you know, average to below average with you know, that level of talent when he had him, and was able to turn that team into a really good team and get the most out of them. And, you know, just the retread coaching thing has always been something that's been interesting to me. I mean, if you're running an organization and you see a guy like Alvin Gentry, who's been around, you know, the Clippers, the Suns, he's been around coaching for a while. Denver, I think he had a small stint. Why wouldn't you go just to hire a top flight assistant, or go hire, you know, a coach that's been out of the league for a little while that had a chance to recharge his batteries? No, you go right for the retread. I mean, you look at almost all the bad teams in the NBA, and they all go from retread coach to retread coach. So it's kind of interesting that a good team like the Memphis Grizzlies don't want to pay Lionel Hollins and are considering pulling in a guy like Alvin Gentry, who has had some success in the league as a coach, but was just on a team where he was coaching last year, and it was a really bad team. So the whole retread philosophy on coaches is just, it's interesting to me. I'm glad the Suns went the route they went. You know, it's interesting to see the route the Bobcats went, you know, Atlanta Hawks, all these teams are, it seems like they're starting to get the impression, go for the young assistant, see what they got, and then if that doesn't work, then you can go back to the retread model. But retread rarely works.
No, I agree with that, and I'm really glad that the Suns have an infusion of new blood, giving some guys their first shot. I like the Hornacek hire a lot. But just a little interesting to me, because I still feel that the Suns really mishandled that whole situation, and that kind of blew up in their face and wasn't one of their shining moments for sure.
Absolutely, and to kind of piggyback off of that into the next thing I wanted us to for sure talk about. So, quick side note, and I'm sure it'll get talked about a little bit more on Brightside, but Jeff Hornacek, he mentioned that when he was with Utah, that they basically played, you know, pin the tail on the coach during summer league, and they just had a different coach every single game, just kind of depending on the matchup and who wanted a coach, and, you know, maybe who stayed out the least late and came home the earliest the night before. That was probably really the rationale behind it. But so he has dabbled a little bit in coaching, but was never the full-on guy like Dan Majerle was for the Suns, just coaching the summer league. He'll be coaching the summer league team this year, he expects, and they should have Kendall Marshall, both Morris twins, and Deontay Garrett there. And it looks like P.J. Tucker volunteered, and they're also going to have their draft picks down there. So if they draft three guys and they bring them all to summer league, there is a very, very good chance that Jeff Hornacek, the actual season head coach, we'll be coaching eight actual guys that'll be on his 12-man roster, and, you know, guys that might end up, he basically will be coaching the collection that will be his entire bench if that ends up being the case. You know, the starters are probably going to be in some way, shape, or manner, you know, Gorin and Dudley and Gortat and Scola and somebody else. So he's basically going to be coaching his entire bench unit as the head coach and going into the summer league coaching all of those guys. So it'll be interesting because he brought in a few assistants. We got a few holes to plug still, but the front office has basically renovated, changed the wallpaper, pulled the carpet, laid down some new tile, threw on a fresh coat of paint, installed some fans. They went for the complete revamp. I think we talked about this a little earlier, Jim. Lon Babbie and Robert Sarver and then players are the only mainstays over when you consider front office or anybody. Two new assistant coaches, one of them is a retread, but new head coach, new general manager, new assistants to the general manager, new head coach, new assistants for the head coach. Just basically just cleaned out the cupboards and starting off from scratch. We're at the grocery store and they're buying the whole new front office.
Yeah, there was definitely a huge shift there. A lot of attrition and then bringing in the new regime. And I fully expect that to extend to the roster. You said there hadn't been that changeover on the roster yet, but obviously there hasn't been an opportunity to start discarding the pieces there that you don't really want. That I fully expect for a couple of veterans to be gone here by the free agency period shortly thereafter. I don't expect them to make it to the season opener. I think that we'll go with more of a youth movement, get some young talent in, and then McMiracle will have a chance, Hornacek, and he will have a chance to evaluate some of the existing young players on the roster, and I'd be surprised if a couple of more of those aren't gone by next summer. So that'll be interesting to see, and it'll hopefully Hornacek doesn't have this inner monologue while he's up there coaching in the summer league that, you know, oh my God, I am so screwed. What did I get myself into? These guys can't play basketball. Hopefully it's a lot more encouraging, optimistic inner monologue there, and we'll have at least some kind of representation there in some form in Vegas for that. So we should be able to keep people apprised of what's going on there.
Yeah, it would definitely be nice to see that. And the one thing that Hornacek said in his introductory conference was when he first started assisting in the NBA, his initial thought was, these guys went to college. They know how to play basketball. I just got to manage their egos and create strategy. That's all we got to do as head coaches. And then, you know, it's completely different than when he came into the league where basically everybody was a four-year senior, or, you know, the early guys that left were like the sophomores and the juniors at the earliest. So he came into the league in a different time, and he learned real fast in Utah that a lot of these guys coming over 18, 19 years old, 1 year in college, maybe, you know, 1 year in Europe or something like that, they're coming into the league not as skilled, not as refined, and you got to do a lot more teaching. So that's really good that he was able to kind of cut his teeth in Utah as an assistant, dealing with a lot of young players. I mean, if you look at their roster, he was there for drafting of Enes Kanter, trading and acquiring of Derek Favors, Gordon Hayward, and Alex Burks, which it was kind of ironic that he mentioned the first three of those guys while talking about the young players he developed. He didn't mention Alec Burke. I think Alec Burks is a guy that they swung and actually missed on. He's a guy that I liked in college, and he's kind of coming around to it. But I thought it was interesting that he was the one young player he didn't mention during the talk today at the workout. But yeah, I mean, he's got that, you know, ability now that he knows that, hey, this is about teaching. There's a lot of teaching that needs to happen. Yeah, you have to strategize as a coach, but you got to teach these guys a lot more than maybe you had to back in his day. And we're gonna close this out on a hypothetical. Things and rumors and conversations and all that have been swirling around. Nerlens Noel's falling and Alex Len is rising, which I think is ironic because neither of them have touched a basketball in months. So I don't know how you can do anything to rise or fall. A lot of it has to do with off-court stuff, with character issues, with the entourage around the players. Alex Len was always viewed as a top four, top five type guy. And now that Nerlens Noel is having a lot of stuff kind of leak out and pop out via agents and through the teams and stuff like that, obviously smokescreen could be in play here, but a lot of I feel genuine talk is going around that Nerlens Noel is starting to build the reputation of a guy that you may not take number one, because you can draft a guy with an entourage and with an attitude and with some potential issues when he has a skill level of a LeBron James or a Dwayne Wade or a Dwight Howard. You don't necessarily do it when the skill level is Nerlens Noel. I know you have a strong opinion on this, Dave, so I'm going to pass it over to you, which is, again, more basketball than Nerlens Noel and Alex Len have been playing while their stock is rising and falling.
This also kind of touches on the dynamic we were just speaking about with Hornacek and the young players, because not only do they lack a lot of these fundamental things they're not coming to the league with, but they also have a sense of entitlement and a lack of work ethic that I see among a lot of players. You can just look at the Suns roster, and that'll be pretty evident to you. And that's across the league, and it seems like some of those issues with the sense of entitlement, that type of thing, might be coming into play for Noel. I can't speak of the discussion about his entourage, these types of things, the way he's handled some of his interviews, his contact with agents, that type of stuff. I will say that the timing of these releases seems too coincidental to be coincidental. So it's very interesting, the timing of this stuff being leaked. And I'll also say that I firmly believe I could walk into a prison and pick a random inmate and have a better sense of trust, that I could trust him, that he's honest in comparison to an NBA agent, because I wouldn't believe anything that comes out of one of their mouths. And I don't know those guys, but I just know how the game's played, and I don't trust them. So that's me. Maybe other people do. Maybe other people, don't share my opinion on that. But with Noel, you have that type of stuff. And what was interesting to me, and I'm going to go ahead and rip into SB Nation a little bit. I'm under their umbrella, and I don't mind dishing out criticism where criticism is due. But they had a story up today where it's talking about Nerlens Noel and his weight. And they're talking about in here that there's a concern about him weighing at 206 pounds. That's terrifyingly low for a player of his size, that it isn't an ideal weight, that it's tough to trust any weight figure after he was listed at 228 pounds by Kentucky and clearly wasn't. Now, they're going to try to participate in the proliferation of ignorance there. And I hear a lot of people that are turned off by this weight, and there's a lot of misinformation out there. So if you want to believe stuff written by random authors not citing sources, then that's fair enough if that's the way you roll. But if I'm going to look at the sources of Kentucky head coach John Calipari, Dr. James Andrews, who is the most eminent doctor in his field in the world, and Chad Ford, who's an ESPN insider that has spoken with both John Calipari and Dr. Andrews, Noel, when at 222 pounds at Kentucky, they don't weigh him every game, but he said when he was injured, he was at 228. He was at 206 pounds then because he had lost weight at the recommendation of Dr. James Andrews, because he said it would help the healing process. Now Dr. James Andrews has given him a clear bill of health in terms of recovering from that injury. He says that he does need to take it slow with his recovery, that he can't force this and come back earlier. It can compromise his future, his health down the road. But he's given him a clean bill of health based off of what's happened there, and says he's gaining back the strength and weight that he lost that was part of this process. So the stuff with his personality, his attitude, that type of stuff obviously raises some red flags, and maybe that's why he's dropping. But this is just an example to me. The weight issue, it's completely a non-issue, and people see it that way, but that's just based off of nonsense. It has nothing to do with the facts of the situation.
Yeah, and I couldn't agree with you more, which is funny because we talked about that a little bit before we came on, and you mentioned the weight issue to me, and we're not sitting next to each other, but I, kind of had the dumbfounded look come up, and then as you continue talking, I was like, oh, yeah, that's right. People were making a big deal about that, and I couldn't care less. And it was something where I've met the kid. I've seen him in person. I've, watched him play basketball. I've been around him for an entire week while he was doing Nike Hoop Summit stuff last year. So, I mean, I've seen how big he is. I know what his frame looks like. He weighed in at 218 back then. He's longer. He's lean. He doesn't have, great, width in his hips. He has real small, thin hips. He has a small frame in general. He's got, kind of broad shoulders where he looks like he can put on some more weight. But, it's going to be tough. I mean, if he gets up to his playing weight by the time training camp starts, and I know he doesn't start playing basketball until December or January, but if he can get up to his playing weight of about 226, pardon me, if he can get up to his playing weight of about 226, 228, whatever that ends up being for him from college, and then build strength, in the weight room until January and December, and he's maybe at about 240, 245, well, then he's 6'11", 240, 245, and I think he'll be okay. There's not a lot of lumbering centers in the NBA. There's a few of them, and they stand out, and you go, yes, there are lumbering centers, but then you start remembering that there's 24, 25 other teams in the NBA that don't have lumbering centers, and the fact that he'll be just okay with that. So I'm going to, just for time purposes, I just want these to be real quick, just say the name for your answer. But I'm going to pose a theory to you. There's a lot of floating out there, Otto Porter, maybe Alex Len goes number one, and I can realistically see that happening either way with one of those two guys. And, with number three would probably be the other one of those two guys, maybe Alex Len or Otto Porter, depending on how that falls. So what could end up happening in the Phoenix Suns' favor is they could end up having Nerlens Noel potentially on the board, and they could also have him on the board with other players. So let's play the name game. You just say who you would prefer the Phoenix Suns, number five, they're on the clock. Nerlens Noel is sitting there, and so is Victor Oladipo. Who are you drafting?
Nerlens Noel.
Nerlens Noel is on the board, and Ben McLemore. Who are you drafting?
McLemore.
Nerlens Noel, and kind of a scenario that doesn't make a ton of sense, but let's say that the crazy cards get played. Nerlens Noel, Alex Len.
Nerlens Noel.
In your mind, basically, Ben McLemore might have just a touch higher of a ceiling than obviously. So what you're saying is that if Nerlens Noel falls, despite the quote-unquote weight issues, despite the maturity and entourage issues, despite the injury that's not going to put him on the court until December, January, you still feel he would be the best option if he happens to fall to number five, except for maybe the scenario where McLemore's there as well.
Right, and my consideration there is the ceiling. And I really feel that Noel and McLemore have the highest ceiling of any players in the draft. And I have a little bit more cause for concern with Noel based off of some of the issues than I do with McLemore. And also, I had done a story about this, and shooting guards and point guards tend to have a lower bust potential than big men, anybody above 6'7", for that matter. It extends to small forwards and power forwards too. So the smaller players have less bust potential, and I guess a lot of that probably makes sense in terms of injuries, everything else that plays into it. So that would be my reasoning. Now, I really don't see a scenario where McLemore and Noel would both be on the board at five, but if either one is at the board at five, then I'm sprinting to the podium to select them.
Yeah, no, good answer, good feedback there. I definitely respect that. And you know what? If Nerlens Noel's on the board and Victor Oladipo's on the board, I'm drafting whoever I think is going to be the player that is going to make the most difference on the roster as you feel it's going to go. Because at the end of the day, they can use a big man because Marcin Gortat's 29 years old and on an expiring contract, and the rest of the big men on this roster are either young and we've seen how good they're going to be, or they're old and they're on their way out the door. So, you know, Noel makes sense to plug in there. And also, this team, more than any other team in the league, probably has a complete lack, void, and need for a shooting guard. So when that comes up, that's an ideal scenario. If Ryan McDonough comes up and the Suns are on the clock and they look up at their board and Nerlens Noel and one of those two shooting guards are still there, I mean, he's basically just sitting there, you know, smiling, beaming from ear to ear, going, which right decision can we make? Because, you know, both of those guys are going to end up being right decisions long term for the franchise. So I don't want to run too long. I know we had a lot of great talk here, and it's a free flow and easy conversation for us. And, you know, you being gone last week, we had a lot of opinions and a lot of words that we needed to get out there. But do you have any parting thoughts here, Jim? Any final words for the Brightsiders?
Didn't get to touch on the SB Nation mock draft stuff so much, the stuff that's going on there. But what I thought was that with that stuff going on is that the way we had kind of had our war room discussions a little bit, that I kind of played the role of Lon Babby in there. And what's funny about that, I think ironic, is that I'm playing Lon Babby despite feeling that he's really not too fond of me at all, because I'm pretty liberal in issuing criticisms and contumelies where the team is concerned. And then I guess kind of accidentally there, coincidentally, like those reports leaking, kind of took a pot shot at him there with the whole never trust an agent type of thing. So I'll leave with this saying, that wasn't directed at you, Lon. You're the exception that proves the rule. So you are the honest agent out there. Just in case you're listening, please don't put a horse head in my bed tonight.
You know what? This ended up just becoming very Lon Babby-esque at the end here. I'm going to throw two things at you. One, today at the Suns workout, Lon approached Dave and said that he's excited to see what the team is supposed to do next in the mock draft. So he's clearly following the mock draft and the strategies of the bright side. And two, if you're the Lon Babby for Dave's, I guess, Ryan McDonough, I don't know what that makes the rest of us. So I'm going to go ahead and forward, Lon, the entire email chain of us debating, bantering, and, you know, talking like we are pretend armchair GMs. I'm going to send him that and see how much he agrees with him being you. How does that sound?
That sounds great. You were, you're tree lore. Seth was Starver.
There you
or
go.
Some of the other guys down as scouts and stuff. But you're the head scout. You're the only legitimate real life scout talent evaluator. So you get to be the head scout. You just don't get to make the decisions. That's Dave's job. He makes all the calls. He's the loudest voice in the room.
Here's the biggest takeaway from what you just said. Nobody was Lance Blanks. We'll talk to you guys next week, one day before the NBA draft. Thanks for listening, guys.